Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I, along with Edward Burke, represent Gerald Moss, the defendant appellant in this case. Your Honors, as you well know, the District Court granted summary judgment for the three supervisors, the President of the University, the Chancellor, and the Provost. However, on the same record, the District Court stripped Dean Moss of his right to qualified immunity and is forcing him to face trial for personal liability without having materially distinguished his conduct from those of the other three supervisors. I submit to the Court that when the correct analysis is applied of qualified immunity, that Dean Moss should not be facing trial either. It is clear that neither the District Court nor opposing counsel has correctly applied or even attempted to apply the two-step analysis required by the Supreme Court when dealing with qualified immunity issue. The facts alleged by the plaintiff did not establish that Dean Moss violated the plaintiff's right to equal protection under the 14th Amendment. Because of the Section 1983 claim, the plaintiff has the burden of showing that Dean Moss engaged in intentional discriminatory conduct. However, it is undisputed, and the District Court agreed, that Dean Moss lacked any knowledge or involvement in any purported unequal treatment of the plaintiff that occurred before Dr. Prabhakar issued his recommendation for a terminal contract on July 1, 1998. Therefore, the relevant inquiry or relevant time period for which the court, this court, should look at in analyzing Dean Moss's conduct would be that time after the recommendation on July 1, 1998, and before he himself approved that recommendation. Now, as the court is well aware, supervisory liability under Section 1983 requires evidence that the supervisor know about discriminatory conduct and facilitated, approve it, condone it, or turn a blind eye for fear of what they might see. That is the plaintiff's burden of proof. And there can be no constitutional violation nor any liability where the supervisor lacks knowledge of the subordinate's purported discriminatory conduct. Now, in this case, the record is clear that there was no evidence that Dean Moss gained any knowledge that Dr. Prabhakar had acted in a discriminatory manner towards... Well, what they did, Your Honor, respectfully, was they came to his office and they said, we think there's been a problem with the process of the issuance of the terminal contract, and there may be gender discrimination or a component of discrimination going on. That's all they told him. These were... Yes, sir. The testimony, Your Honor, is that he denied telling that to Dr. Hoffman, that Dr. Prabhakar had the approval of the faculty for the issuance of the recommendation. So he denies telling him that, telling her that. The evidence in the record... The other faculty members reported to Dean Moss that there had not been the what they felt was the appropriate process And if I may digress for one quick moment, because I think it's important, is that this issue of whether or not process was followed is not by any means a clear-cut requirement in the record. The record was replete with the fact that the university's own personnel were not clear on what the requirement was on the department head, Dr. Prabhakar, to obtain faculty advisory committee input. The university statutes in the section that deals with the requirements of the head and what he must do not speak to that. Dr. Prabhakar went to the dean's office, not to Dean Moss, but to his subordinates, and asked for advice of what he was supposed to do in that regard. And he was told, you don't have to have it. You don't have to have it. It might be advisable to get it, but you don't have to have it. I think what he said was that he anticipated he would have gotten opposition to his decision, because the people that were making the complaints to the dean's office about this were three professors who were opposed to his appointment as head. Dr. Prabhakar? That's what I'm saying, is Dr. Prabhakar was told that he did not have to go to the faculty. And in fact, this process issue, again, to highlight the fact that it really doesn't bear the kind of weight that it's being given, two investigations by Dr. Cohen and Dr. Knoffel, who are both highly respected professors within the university and department heads, Dr. Cohen was a department head, investigated this very allegation of procedural violations, alleged procedural violations, and whether or not gender or discrimination was involved. And both of them found that there was not a procedural violation. What our brief says, Your Honor, respectfully, is that he received information that caused him to conclude, not get an inference, but to conclude that there was unequal treatment. So if having that knowledge or having drawn a conclusion that Dr. Prabhakar had engaged in unequal treatment, then yes, under the law, he had a duty not to turn away from it or hide it. No, I respectfully, Judge, I think what he needs is to put Dean Moss, on notice, is somebody coming in and giving him concrete allegations of unequal treatment. In other words, we know, for instance, that Dr. Prabhakar is treating male members of the department differently. He's paying them more. He's giving them premium space, better equipment. Well, that's a part of university life, and I think it's clear that Dr. Prabhakar made many people upset because he was charged with reallocating lab space in the whole department. There were male members that were upset about it. There were female members. So you can't draw any adverse inference from the fact that faculty members were upset about it. But just to conclude briefly, if you allow this Dr. Dean Moss to be stripped of his qualified immunity on these types of facts, then you're putting every administrator in a public university or a public entity at risk for people coming in and sitting in their office and saying, I think that the decision against me was based on gender. And I don't think that's what the law requires. I think that there is concrete evidence an allegation had to have been made that there was disparate treatment going on, and that was not the case here. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Larry Cream. Mr. Wright, Judge. Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning. You had asked a question about Moss's statement to Hoffman that the faculty was behind this. And I think it's important to keep in mind that Moss does not deny making the statement. He testified in his deposition. He doesn't remember making the statement. And the defense tries to trumpet the Knoefel and Cohen hearings as saying, well, they were aware that Moss lied to Hoffman. And truth and in fact, there's no such testimony. There's no citation to the record in their brief because they can't, because it didn't happen. Because no one knew about Moss's statement to Hoffman until she gave her deposition. Hoffman never testified before Cohen. She never testified before Hoffman. So the suggestion that the university investigated Hoffman's misstatement, or excuse me, Moss's misstatement to Hoffman simply isn't accurate. Please. No, and that's not what happened here, because what happened here is when confronted with three senior faculty members and Dr. Nanda herself that her firing was discriminatory, his response was, don't you dare threaten me. If Hoffman doesn't back me on this, she'll have my resignation tomorrow. That's turning a blind eye. That is a man who feels it's more important to, as he said, as three faculty members testified, that if I don't support Prabhakar on this because it's a principle, we have to get behind our department heads, that we're going to have chaos here. And I think this court should send a strong message that furthering discrimination isn't chaos. It shouldn't be allowed. And you've got a man who ignores four faculty members who come to him for help. He said, I don't care if there's discrimination. There's going to be chaos if I don't uphold this. I'm going to resign if this isn't upheld. And then he goes and tells his boss that the faculty's really behind this. And it's not Prabhakar who told him that. He knew that. The faculty themselves told Moss that none of them supported it, that there was no scientific or academic basis for it, that it was likely discriminatory. And then what he does is instead of rescinding the contract, is he goes ahead and puts it through. And the defense likes to point to the fact that there was this investigation by Cohen. But the point is, Moss had already made up his mind and already forwarded the recommendation to fire Nanda before Cohen was appointed. Moss didn't appoint Cohen to find out whether he should uphold the firing. Had Moss rescinded the firing, Cohen never would have been appointed. And he didn't appoint Cohen at his own behest. He did so because Hoffman told him to. And he had already poisoned Hoffman by telling her that falsely, that the faculty supported this. And as Hoffman testified, that was extremely important to her because if the faculty supported it, it was less likely to be discriminatory. If the faculty did not support it, it was more likely to be discriminatory. And that's what happened if he stacked the deck against Nanda. That's an administrator who facilitates, turns a blind eye, allows discrimination to happen. Dean didn't rely on those reports. His decision was already made before Cohen was appointed. Cohen was appointed to look into his. Then it went to Hoffman, the next level. Hoffman appointed Knoefel, not Moss. Then it goes up the chain of command, and by the time it gets to the president of the university, it only is decided on procedural issues. It wasn't up to him at that point, because once these other people came in, they were, that's the next step in the process. The time for Moss to have changed his mind was when there were people claiming there was discrimination. And another thing that happened that you have to keep in mind, too, is before Moss told Hoffman that the faculty was behind this, Moss met with Gene Woods, who was the chairman of the Academic Freedom and Tenure Committee, and told Judge Woods that no one had ever been fired without prior faculty input. No man had ever been fired without prior faculty input. It was wrong. It was inappropriate. We'll never do it again. And then Moss gets Cohn's report and cites Cohn's report and says, since there was faculty input, I'm upholding your firing. And so what he does is he takes a situation where there is no prior faculty input, which makes this an arbitrary decision. He knows it's likely motivated by gender discrimination, and his response is, I don't care, I'm going to resign if it's not upheld. Judge Pallmeyer didn't discuss it in detail, but my answer to that, Judge, is the following. A reasonable administrator would know in 1998 that you do not ratify a firing that you know is motivated by discrimination. A reasonable administrator in 1998 knows that you don't uphold discriminatory firings on a matter of principle or think it's chaos if that firing is not upheld. A reasonable administrator was on notice in 1998 that putting a prior priority on firing somebody to uphold discrimination and remedying discrimination is unlawful. A reasonable administrator who knows that no man was ever fired in violation of university procedure without prior faculty input, who admits it's unjust and inappropriate but does it anyway, should know that's unconstitutional. And finally, a reasonable administrator should have been on notice that lying to his boss that the faculty supported this just so his boss would think that the discrimination was less likely is illegal. And we did cite Jones versus Chicago in our brief, which they've ignored, which is a similar situation where you had people who were trying to mislead an investigation, in that case by preparing a misleading report, in the Nanda case by lying to your superior. Jones was in part a conspiracy, Judge, but I believe it is analogous because you have someone who is providing false information with the intent to influence the outcome of the investigation. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Just to follow up on the point the court made, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor, that had these investigations come out a different way, Dean Moss had the ability to reverse the decision. And not only Dean Moss, but everybody up the chain from Dean Moss, when they both agreed with the terminal contract recommendation, as well as through the grievance process, after testimony and evidence and hearings were held, where all of this, what we've just discussed, all of these facts were aired out at length, could have changed their decision. My other point is that I don't know how a reasonable finding could be made that a person who conducted his own investigation, spoke to the principals involved, made his own decision, went to the academic record to review it to determine whether or not he felt, as a dean of the College of Medicine, that this person should receive a terminal contract, how anyone could say that is turning a blind eye to an allegation. He went to all of these sources before he made his decision, and the district court correctly found there was no evidence that Dean Moss himself harbored any discriminatory motives. So we respectfully ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court. Thanks.